Thank you, Steve Bertrand. Now I'm live on the air. I got some friends in the studio with us right now, and I can't visit with you guys. We're trying to do a show. It's 11:35 on WGN. You heard that tinkling sound in the background, didn't you? That was us connecting with the third president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, who we haven't talked to in a while. Mr. Jefferson, are you there?
Hello to you, citizen.
Hey! TJ, how are you? I mean, Mr. Jefferson, how are you?
Well, it's springtime at Monticello, so we're very busy getting the tobacco in, and my vegetable garden, which is huge, takes an enormous amount of time, and I'm grafting some fruit trees also.
You know, it's funny because what you guys used to do, that is, essentially provide your own food, is what a lot of people are thinking about doing themselves now, like being more aggressive about having a garden or finding a way to take care of their own food supply because it's seemed to be a little in jeopardy. Did you guys, but you must have had grocery stores of some sort back in your day, right?
Well, people who lived in the cities like Boston or Philadelphia or New York and possibly Williamsburg would have had some access to what you might call a grocery store, but it was very primitive. And 97% of the American people in my time were still small farmers, family farmers. So most people produced some of, if not all of, their own food. So at Monticello, for example, we had huge gardens to feed ourselves, but also an experimental garden because I was interested in new plants and new vegetables. We had orchards, so we got our fruit from there. And then I had herds of cattle and sheep and sometimes goats. So people in my time were much more self-sufficient. And as you know, in my only book, Notes on the State of Virginia, which was printed in 1785, I said, those who labor in the earth are the chosen people of God because they're more independent than people who depend on stores or entities they can't control for their livelihood. So I would urge everyone in any time, even though more than 200 years have passed since my life, I would urge everyone who's listening this year to grow some of your own food, even a fraction of it, because it will make you feel more independent and it will make you more happy and virtuous.
97% of the people in your era lived on family farms?
Either lived directly on farms or had farm plots. So that, you know, the overwhelming majority of the people were small-scale farmers. In your time, I understand that the percentage is under 2%. And I believe that we could not be an actual republic unless the majority, and indeed the great majority of us, were family farmers. So one reason why you're having such a hard time remaining a republic is that you have created an urban and suburban culture where people are dependent for their food supply and their fuel and their shelter on entities that they can't control and maybe don't even fully understand.
Yeah, well, we're learning now how little we know about that. You know, the reason I thought about you the other day, Mr. Jefferson, is, and by the way, Thomas Jefferson on a phone line, give us a call, 312-981-7200 if you want to say hi. Mr. Jefferson and I appear regularly on stage in the Chicago area, often in the spring, always in the fall. We have a conversation on stage. You get to ask questions. We have some laughs and learn a lot. This year's show, I'm afraid to report, Mr. Jefferson, has had to be been postponed because of the coronavirus.
I'm sorry to hear that. You know, there was a pandemic, certainly an epidemic in my time in Philadelphia in 1793. By the way, the U.S. government was stationed there at the time. That was our national capital for 10 years. There was a yellow fever outbreak. Philadelphia at the time had a population of about 50,000. And before it ended, 4 or 5 months later, 1 in 10 residents of Philadelphia was dead. You know, it swept away 1 out of every 10 people, particularly in the more densely populated part of the city and particularly amongst the poor. The government was there, and Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury, actually got the yellow fever. He was lucky enough to survive it, but many people weren't. It was a devastating plague that you don't hear much about in your time, but it was a central fact of life in our time. And what the difference, sir, is that we didn't understand the virus. We didn't have a germ theory of medicine. We didn't know where a plague came from. We didn't really know how it was transferred from one person to another. And we didn't know, we had no vaccines. We had no method of combating it.
No hope of it. So did you guys, so then you didn't practice social distancing or anything like that?
We did. And so during that period, people realized that they must create some social distance, that whatever else was true, the yellow fever was being transferred by close proximity and maybe by bodily contact. So people actually stopped shaking hands. And the cessation of handshaking lasted for a long time after the plague went away. And people would cross to the other side of the street to avoid houses that were quarantined. What they were doing at the time was painting a red cross, a large red X or a red cross on the doors of houses that were known to be infected. And people would do anything possible to distance themselves from those quarantine sites.
And this was in what year? 1790s?
1793, I was the Secretary of State, and Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury, and George Washington was serving his first term as the President of the United States.
How do I not know this part in American history? So at that time, in the capital of Philadelphia, they were combating a plague so virulent that 1 in 10 people passed away. Wow.
Yeah, so think of Chicago, where you live. Imagine if by September 1st, 1 in 10 people of Chicago were dead from your current pandemic.
You know, it's funny that they paint a red X on the door. I think today that would not go. We are beating ourselves up about how much power we cede to the government to control our lives about this, even as our lives are at stake.
Well, I do have concerns about that, because when governments take control, if they assume new powers in an emergency, they seldom relinquish those policies, those powers, after the difficulty that the crisis has passed. And so every time the government gains ground, liberty tends to yield. And in spite of the promises that government makes that it will return to normal order once the crisis is over, this almost never happens completely. And so I share the concern of your citizens about this. On the other hand, when there's time of war, certain liberties must be put in abeyance, must be temporarily suspended. You know, in this situation, you have apparently one of the worst crises in modern American history. And in spite of the 10th Amendment, there are times when you must turn to the national government for coordination of a national response to these things. And as it's a cliche, I suppose, but as you know, a plague does not recognize the boundary between Pennsylvania and New York, or the boundary between Virginia and Kentucky.
Or the boundary between Peoria and East Peoria. We had the mayor of a central Illinois town on yesterday, and he's the mayor of East Peoria, and he's ahead of Peoria in terms of liberating his businesses and his people, to say nothing of Chicago. They have a lower incidence there. We have a much, much, much higher incidence in Chicago and the surrounding counties. And so they're like, we don't care what the governor says. We're going to tell our businesses they can start to open up. We talked this morning to a barber in Michigan. It's a small town, but he is getting fined $1,000 at maybe a day for breaking the governor's orders. He's like, I need to make money. You cannot do this to me. This is not only un-American, it may just be bad strategy to cripple the economy in the hopes of driving this virus down to some, you know, subjective number, some target. So he said, screw it. I'm going to open up. I'm going to make money and I'm going to pay my bills. What do you make of that sort of push and pull, Mr. Jefferson?
I think that there's something that I admire in the spirit of the American people to resist government intrusion and always to demand that government justify itself for any intrusion that it makes on our liberties. I think that's a useful spirit, even a rebellious spirit that's at the heart of the American people. So I wouldn't necessarily discourage it. On the other hand, in the face of something like this, you are so much more advantaged than we were, because you know how these things work. You're headed towards a vaccine. You know how virus is transmitted from one person to the next. We were simply bewildered and just went about our lives because we didn't quite know what else to do. In your time, you have an epidemiology, you know, a science of how disease is created and transferred and finally overcome. And I would say that the most important advice I could give to the people of your time is bow with deep respect to the scientists and the physicians, because in our time, Dr. Rush, for example, in Philadelphia, the hero of the yellow fever epidemic, his two methods of curing people were bleeding and purging, neither one of which helped anybody. You know, he was just desperate, and he did what he could, but by bleeding people, he actually dehydrated them and hastened their death.
Okay, Thomas Jefferson's on a phone line. I said, give us a call if you want to say hi to him, and all our phone lines are ringing. 312-981-7200 if you want to say hello. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, frequently joins us in person in Chicago and on stage. This year, our fall show postponed because of coronavirus. We thought we'd call him up. Are you still there, Mr. Jefferson?
Yes, sir.
By the way, one other thing I was just going to cleverly remind people is you were saying, you know, you guys have vaccines, you guys have medicine. And I was going to say, you guys had snuff. What was the hygiene like back in your day? We are so hyper careful now, sir. We're washing ourselves, using alcohol to clean our fingers. We're wiping down doorknobs. Some people get home from work, they strip their clothes and take a shower. How clean or careful were you all?
Not very much. You know, I know this is hard for people of your era to understand, but we really didn't understand the basic concept of hygiene. Doctors and surgeons worked on patients without washing their hands. They did not wash their medical instruments between surgeries or other administrations of medicine. People seldom bathed. The average person in America in my time bathed a few times per year. Total immersion bathing was regarded in some places as unhealthful. People washed a little bit. You know, they would wash their private parts and their faces and maybe their hands, but not before meals. There was no real science of dentistry. People didn't brush their teeth. Anyone in your time going back into my world in Williamsburg or Philadelphia or Washington, D.C. would probably be overwhelmed with the aroma of humans. I'm sure that the Congress would have smelled like a locker room in your time after a strenuously fought basketball game or something. So it was a very, very different time, and we probably spread a great deal of disease by not understanding. I was more fastidious than most people. I did brush my teeth. I actually had a toothpick system to make sure that I didn't have any bacteria or other agents working in my mouth, but most people, by your standards, were deplorably unclean.
You think it would dawn on them when they got out of the river, say, or lake, they go, that feels pretty good. I think I'll do that every day. And then quick, somebody invents soap. But did you have soap? Did you have showers? Did you have bathtubs?
We did not have showers. We did not really have bathtubs, although we had something that was on the road to the bathtub. We did have soap, of course, and we, you know, laundered our clothes and we used soap, but it was not a routine thing. We drank alcohol in such great quantities because water was not treated then, and so people had to be concerned about this. It was just a different way of seeing life, and there was a great deal of disease. So if Philadelphia then had the systems of sanitation and hygiene that it has now, it's almost certain that not one in 10 Philadelphians would have died of the yellow fever. It might have been 1 in 100. It might have been 1 in 1,000, because you know so much more than we did. And I can't tell you how much you ought to take advantage of that, that knowledge is power, said Francis Bacon, one of my three heroes. You're in a position to know what's going on in the world. When we were simply bewildered in Philadelphia, people actually took guns out into the streets and shot muskets into the air out of desperation, thinking maybe that would break up the unwholesomeness of the atmosphere. And we were dealing in dead ignorance. And some preachers were saying this was God's way of visiting his judgment on humanity, that we deserved the plague, and that any public health measures that were taken were counter to God's providence.
Okay, let's take a couple phone calls for Thomas Jefferson, third president of these United States. We'll start with Jackson. You're on WGN. Go ahead, Jackson. You're on the air.
Thomas Jefferson. I just had my last question.
Sure, you're on the air.
Less about the virus going around and more about the Bill of Rights.
Go ahead.
And just looking for a yes or no question. Does the Second Amendment protect the First?
Second Amendment is an absolute. It means that you have the right to keep and bear arms, and government must make no attempt to get in the way of that.
Right, and the reason it was made was to protect the First Amendment, correct?
No, it was made so that if you needed to bring down your government, you could do so, and it was made so that we would have a militia system, a volunteer weekend army, rather than a permanent military establishment. It was designed to prevent what was known as a standing army, which we had discovered from history had destroyed the liberties of all the peoples who had ever had a permanent military establishment.
I haven't heard it put that way before, Jackson. Thanks for the call. The Second Amendment is there to protect the First. So to ensure that I have free speech, I've got a gun. Ensure that I have individual liberties, I have a gun. You're not saying that exactly. You're saying it was to overthrow the government. Maybe that's the same thing.
To protect from home invasion. But our biggest concern was a permanent military establishment. Now, you have one. You have an army, you have a navy, you have an air force, you have a Coast Guard, etc., National Guard. Our idea was the Minutemen, that farmer citizens would gather in the public square with their muskets, and they would then drill from time to time. And if there were an invasion, as say at Lexington and Concord, they would be able to repel the professional army of the British. And so we wanted a militia, not a permanent military, and the only way to do that, of course, is that farmer citizens have guns and know how to use them. And so we guaranteed their access to guns so that if you have the guns provided by your government, it's not a militia in any meaningful sense. But you also have a right to a gun, in my opinion, in case you need to bring down your government from time to time.
Lou, you're on WGN Radio with the third president of the USA. Go ahead, Lou, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mr. Jefferson. I just want to say this is a normal time for us to have jokes on this program. And I was wondering if you could tell us a joke from your era.
Yes, I only have one joke, but I'm glad you asked.
Oh, boy.
I was not a very funny person. I was amused by things, but I was not someone who laughed, and I never told jokes. You really want to have James Madison on this program because he loved to tell after-dinner jokes, and some of them were of a rather risque nature. But here's my joke.
Okay.
I got a letter from a young man. This happened. A young man wrote to me and said, "Mr. Jefferson, there are 155 members of the Congress of the United States, and so little gets done. Why is that, sir?" I wrote back and said, "Young man, whenever you gather 150 lawyers into one room at one time, nothing good can come of it. These are, after all, men who are paid to talk by the hour."
Good joke. It works now, too.
Hilarious. Okay.
That's all I have, sir. I'm afraid that's the sum total of my humor.
That'll do it.
Well, that will do it. Thank you for the call there, Lou. Yeah, I wouldn't tip your waiters generously, folks. I don't know that there's a career for you outside of politics, Mr. Jefferson.
I'll be here for the next 250 years.
That's the line. All right. Maybe you could join us again. A lot of people are texting in saying hi. They miss you. They always appreciate your wisdom and thoughtfulness, sir. This is just a little bit of a history lesson this time, going back in time and recollecting how fortunate we are. And I don't know if that maybe informs some decisions that we're making these days, but it was nice to hear your voice today, TJ.
I so appreciate it. I have 20 more seconds of things I want to say, and this is that. We grew our own food. That meant if the system collapsed, as yours is doing, we could still feed and clothe ourselves. I urge everyone who is listening to find some way to grow something, a rutabaga, a potato, a tomato, something in the next few months, because it will help you to realize that humans have basic needs and basic economies that you have left behind, and you have left them behind to your great perplexity and jeopardy.
There he goes. Third President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, leaving us now. And